From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 2, recorded Monday, January 16th, 2006. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Automated QA, makers of Test Complete, providing automated testing of Windows, .NET Framework, Java, and web applications. Online at www.automatedqa.com. And by peterbloom.com. Start with better controls, finish with better sites. Online at www.peterbloom.com. Support is also provided by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at dotnet.sys-con.com.
Hey, this is Carl Franklin, Hansel Minutes, show number 2. Take it away, Scott.
Hi, everyone. I really appreciate all your feedback on Hansel Minutes number 1. This is show number 2. We've got a whole pile of content for you, don't we, Carl?
Yes, we do, Scott.
Notice that Carl is doing the best he can not to waste your time.
Yes, I don't want to waste anybody's time today.
And we've already wasted about 20 seconds, so let's get right to it. So, cool stuff this week for me. I've got a number of different things that I've been thinking about around hardware, and it's showed up on the net in a couple different places, but I've been checking out this Optimus keyboard because I recently just bought myself a Microsoft Wireless Laser Keyboard 6000. But this Optimus keyboard is one of those things that was done as a student example or, you know, a student senior project, and they're talking about actually creating it. It's a keyboard by which every single key is a little LCD color screen. I personally use an ErgoDex, E-R-G-O-D-E-X, ErgoDex.com, which has a bunch of blank keys, and you can actually arrange them any way that you want. They're sticky on the back, and I play things like Guild Wars. I've also used it for Code Rush to set up macros, so it's basically a macro pad with detachable keys. But the idea that I could change the look and feel of my entire keyboard just by reprogramming all of the faces sounds pretty attractive. And they're saying it's going to come in only at about $200-$300, which is right about at the amount that my wife wouldn't notice if I bought without telling her.
The thing, Scott, that I find weird about that is that, you know, if you have a different keyboard for every program you're going to use, you might have a little trouble getting used to, now, where is this key right now?
Yeah.
So things move around on you. That could be
tricky.
That's
a totally valid point, but I was thinking about that. We say, even myself as someone who's got a pile of tools, like my list up at Hanselman.com/tools, that I use these 1,500 programs, but there's a very crisp kind of power curve where there's like the top 10 applications that I use every single day. And I don't think that I would go and set up a special keyboard for an application I use twice a week.
Right. You know, for the totally sick and twisted, you can go to datahand.com. Have you seen Datahand?
I have seen the Datahand. That was just a little too strange for my taste. I think that a keyboard...
I actually bought one, Scott.
Wow.
I actually bought one. I haven't used it. I tried it, and it's going to take a lot of practice to get good at that. Go to datahand.com. You'll see what I mean. It's insane.
Probably not for me, but we will see. I'm definitely taking a look at DOS Keyboard at diskeyboard.com, right. The blank hacker's keyboard. Not just because it's blank and people would think you were cool because you were using a keyboard that had nothing marked on it, and it's actually a lookalike keyboard from Belkin now, but
yeah.
Because each of the keys is individually weighted. I've always found that I have more pain on my pinky and my ring finger because all the keys are weighted at about, I think, 40 grams or micrograms of pressure that is required to make the key go down. The DOS keyboard actually makes the keys weighted specifically for the stronger fingers.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at checking that out, and I'll hopefully have a review up on my blog pretty soon.
Hey, you're into MAME, right?
Big time. I've got a lot of MAME stuff running. I've been using a thing called MAME EX. MAME EX is actually a Media Center PC front end for MAME so that I can actually launch from my Media Center PC this MAME interface that lets me select all the different emulations and games that I want. And MAME EX can actually act a little bit as its own Media Center PC, and it was written in .NET, which is pretty slick.
You know, I think it would be valuable to describe MAME because I really don't think that a lot of people know about it.
I think a lot of people...
Am I wrong?
I think a lot of people have heard of it, but a lot of people haven't actually tried downloading and getting a game to work. MAME means Multi-Arcade Machine Emulator, and there's a number of... It started out in DOS. There's a number of different... there's MAME for Windows. MAME is an open source thing that's written entirely in C, so it's been ported to almost every platform. There's a Mac-specific MAME, a Linux MAME. There's MAME for the... I believe that there's even MAME for like the iPod, and anytime a small device comes out to really prove that we can hack that device, someone tries to port things over via MAME. And interestingly, as machines are getting more and more powerful and languages are getting more and more powerful, more and more stuff is being set up to emulate MAME. Like, I was up at game-oldies.com. It's an emulation website that basically gives you MAME anywhere, anytime in a browser using the Java runtime, and you can go and pick up games. I don't know what the legality of that is, but that doesn't mean I won't play them as much as I can until they get shut down.
There's always been a gray area around MAME ROMs because they are essentially ripped ROMs right from the original arcade machines.
Exactly, and technically you're only supposed to run the MAME game if you actually have that full upright, $5,000 version of Donkey Kong Jr. in your basement.
Right.
Then you are legally okay. But I think even technically, according to Digital Millennium copyright law, if someone was downstairs playing your Donkey Kong game at the same time you were on the emulator, you would not be allowed to play that.
Huh.
It's a very, very gray area, but I was still pretty impressed.
Okay. So what is this PSP-like device you were talking about? Do we have a link for that? And speaking of that, where are all the links?
So all the links right now, we've been using different things like Shrinkster, EarlX.org, Earl123.com. Last time we used Tiny Earl. For now, for this show, let's give this a try. This is show number 2. All of the links will be up at the show number 2 section of HanselMinutes.com. You can go up there and find it, and I'll probably also put some of the links up at Delicious, del.icio.us. And I'll talk more about Delicious on show number 3. But this PSP-like device is up in a co.uk, so I won't even bother reading it to you. But the device is called a GP2X. And this is a small $200 Linux-based device. It's not quite the chutzpah that a PSP has, but it's a small portable handheld device that runs Linux, and people are using it as a I wouldn't say a poor man's PSP, but definitely kind of the hacker-friendly PSP. People have been struggling with this wrestling back and forth as Sony tries to shut them down and the homebrew applications keep coming back. This device actually comes with an SDK and says, please hack me. As such, they've come up with MAME, Doom ports, Quake ports for this thing. And it's actually working out pretty nicely. I think that the price point is right. A couple $100 is right about where the geeks can handle it. And porting things over to that, like video players and other Linux software, is happening at a very fast pace. So if you're thinking about a PSP, maybe check out the GP2X. It might be more what you're wanting to do.
I mean, the biggest problem with buying a piece of hardware like that for portable gameplay is you get the games that are made for it, and that's it. This seems to be a really, really cool hacker's delight.
Now, I personally bought a PSP because I'm really less interested in the games and more interested in the video aspects. I bought a PSP as an inexpensive portable media center because I felt at the time, this was last year, that the media center portables from Microsoft just were a little too expensive. I couldn't justify $400. I could justify less for a PSP. And up at furrygoat.com, he's taken advantage of this wireless built-in Wi-Fi that the PSP has, and he's actually got 20 gigs of external storage set up. So he's actually downloading stuff in his own kind of internal Wi-Fi network. So even though he's got a 1 gig memory card for videos and such, he can go up and download new, fresh content from his 20 gig external drive. Basically, what he did is he found a drive enclosure that takes laptop hard drives, but the enclosure also acts as a NAS, as a network attached storage. And the drive enclosure actually has Wi-Fi built in. And since it has Wi-Fi and the PSP has Wi-Fi, he worked out some kind of Unix hacking and some scripts to have those guys talk to each other.
Tasty.
It is. It's pretty nice. It's at furrygoat.com. We'll have the full link at the Hansel Minutes show number 2. Now, that's a little too hardcore for me, but as we're podcasters, and if it's pretty hardcore, if it involves running VI, I've pretty much given those things up. I can run Pico, but I can't run VI anymore.
All right. So, and also we had a correction about something you said about the video on the Xbox 360 last week.
Right. Now, I have been doing a lot of different stuff with the Xbox 360. I've been downloading audio. I've been watching video, but I've been doing the video watching via the Media Center Extender technology, the idea that you can remote desktop into a Media Center PC. This is the Windows XP Media Center Edition, and you basically get a complete experience as if you were sitting in front of the Media Center. This is not the watered-down Media Center Extender stuff of the past. The Xbox 360 is actually updated. There's a specific update for the Windows XP Media Center PC Edition called Roll Up 2 that gives you this functionality, but you can only watch video either A, that's downloaded from the Xbox Live Marketplace, which is content that Microsoft supports
right.
and puts up there, or B, via this remoting. So you need to have this this functionality set up on a Media Center PC. Okay. I've set one up and put it in a closet.
Looks nice.
Oh, it looks fantastic. It looks absolutely fantastic. And since we're talking about podcasting, we're on a podcast now, you can do video casting with a tool called Videora. And Videora is basically a podcasting application that downloads video and then does something with the video once it's come down. A lot of people use it for video casting to their PSP. There's a number of different TV shows that you can download that are kind of underground TV shows. They're often in DivX format or formats that aren't necessarily Microsoft friendly. Videora will actually bring this content down and either squish it and put it onto your PSP automatically, or it will squish it and put it into a folder and set it up ready to be watched from an Xbox 360 via Media Center. But if you're not into kind of that packaged experience, at brainsandbrawn.com, and again, that's a link we'll put up at Hansel Minutes, Casey Chestnut has got instructions on how to download DivX, which is a very highly compressed MPEG-4 format, DivX codec videos, and actually do on-the-fly transcoding from wow. those DivX format to a WMV, which then could be watched on your 360 via the Media Center extender.
Wow, that's cool.
I've had a number of people come over to the place, and I've shown them the Xbox 360, and they've actually said, I'm not interested in the games, just as I'm not interested in the games on the PSP that much. They said, you're saying I could fill my house with an Xbox 360 in each room and have a video extender experience in each room. And I think we're getting to that place. They've snuck this thing into our house, and it is going to become a media hub without us even realizing it.
And Google stuff. You got a lot of Google stuff to talk about this week, right?
You know, Google, their motto is do no evil, but you know, I don't know how someone could bring out such good software so much, so often. It's like every 5 minutes they've got something going out on their site without at least having sold one of their souls, maybe Sergey's, to the devil. Because Google Pack is fantastic. It's basically, you know, Google Update, just like we've got Microsoft Update. And that came out recently. And I hope that rather than using it as a venue for pushing commercial software out, they use it as a venue for getting good open source software out there. But it's Google Earth that's really been impressing the heck out of me. And there's a website called fboweb.com that has got flight tracking in Google Earth. Now, we're talking about Google Earth here, not Google Maps. Google Earth right. is the 3D topography. They take all of this information. They layer on the topography, the satellite data. During Hurricane Katrina, they brought up NOAA data. And they've got flight tracking working even with altitude. So you can take your virtual Earth and twist it and actually watch the planes, the virtual planes landing. And I'm all about the flight tracking software. I've got relatives that come in from Africa every year, and we always watch for 2 days with kind of rapt attention as we see their flights coming over from Johannesburg. Now, on the Google Maps side, of course, the world is flat part of Google, lots and lots of different Google mashups. You can do these mashups also with Virtual Earth, which right. is Microsoft's virtual mapping software. But packagemapper.com is such a fantastically useful thing. I'm constantly trying to see where my packages are. And I usually just have that little boring grid that you see at UPS that says here it's in Poughkeepsie. Now you can actually have a pushpin show up with a where it is, how it's getting there, and a visual representation of where your package is up at packagemapper.com. You know, and actually another one off the top of my head is Nikhil Kotari's Virtual Places. It's kind of a playground for Ajax and Microsoft's ASP.NET 2.0 Atlas preview of their Ajax technology. And Nikhil's doing some pretty amazing stuff. And mm-hmm. it's almost all a mashup with Virtual Earth. His site is hosting it. And photos, geolocation. You can go to Portland, Oregon on the map there, zoom in and say, show me RSS feeds that are in this wow. general area. And he'll actually put a little XML RSS orange badge at the location in latitude and longitude that you have geotagged your particular feed to say you locate at. This geotagging is actually something you can do to your RSS feed to say, oh, I am broadcasting, quote unquote, broadcasting from this particular location.
Yeah.
So I get to see what other bloggers are in Portland. It's pretty fantastic stuff.
That's awesome. And speaking of Portland, there's something going on with Google just in Portland?
Yeah, TriMet is the transit authority in Portland, and they've always been very kind of forward-looking in their technology views, and their IT department is really fantastic. The TriMet website at try-met.org has always had some really neat Java applets, JavaScript things to pop up and tell you when you need to go running for the bus. But Google Maps has actually set up a Google Transit site, and they're initially interfacing with data from TriMet. So when you do directions, you always go up to MapQuest or maps.google.com, and you say, get me from point A to point B, and they always kind of assume that you're going to be driving in a car. With Google Right. Transit, they interface with TriMet, and they say, walk 3 miles west, stop here, get on this particular bus, take the train, yada, 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 all these things. And even they tell you how much money you will save taking transit, mass transit, versus versus taking a car. So they'll say it would cost you $1.85 in gas, but it cost you $1.05 to take the train. And I think that they're going to start expanding that out. And I think that for New Yorkers, if they could figure out a way to interface with the metro system in New York, the idea that I could come in from Brooklyn either in my car and park and factor in all those kinds of things, or I could take the train, could be a real coup for New Yorkers trying to find directions.
Serious, serious time saver. I hope to see that in other states.
Totally.
And speaking of time savers, portableapps.com.
Yeah, lately I've been all about trying to have my my life on a USB key. I wrote on my blog recently about a getaway key. Like if your house blew up and you needed to get away, what would you put on a USB key to run away and make sure that you could get things handled even though your house had been destroyed? And I started looking for different things you can put on your USB key. And portableapps.com is this great website that has got all sorts of applications that run via basically an xcopy deploy. There, you copy them onto your USB key, things like Firefox, things like Sunbird, the calendaring application, Thunderbird, OpenOffice, and you run them directly off your USB key. You never know when you're going to find a person's machine. They've got Microsoft Works on it. You go to your mom's house. You carry your data with you on your USB key. Why not carry some of your applications, your favorite?
So now, do you have to boot up a version of Linux that's on the key too, or
no? These are all the Windows versions of these open source applications.
Oh, the Windows versions. Okay.
Yeah, and they're totally portable. So, for example, sometimes you might go, it might be traveling. You know, again, we travel in Africa a lot. Oftentimes, we don't bring our laptop because Wi-Fi is not pervasive. So we'll go to a cyber cafe.
Yeah.
And I don't have access to their machine. I can't go as administrator and start installing things, and they're looking over my shoulder. But I might have a chat program and a version of a word processor. They don't have Excel because they didn't buy a license. So I've got OpenOffice right there on my key. So why not take your apps along with your data?
Have you ever had a situation, just out of curiosity, where you've been told to not run that because that's not an app that's on our computer?
I have had situations where they caught me downloading stuff. Yeah. And I have had situations where they spotted me poking around in the registry.
Hey, this is Carl Franklin. Check out Test Complete from automatedqa.com. Test Complete does automated testing of Windows, .NET Framework, Java, and web applications. It's won Jolt Awards 2 years in a row from Software Development Magazine. Even though it's been voted best testing tool, Test Complete is really affordable. It costs just a fraction of what you'd have to pay for its nearest big-name competitor. Test Complete is standards-based and extensible with a well-documented plugin API. And the test scripts use familiar languages, VBScript, JavaScript, C# script, C++ script, and even Delphi script. You choose the language that works best for your team. You don't have to buy a dozen different modules to test all your applications. Test Complete is a full test development environment. It has features like an easy-to-use Windows test recorder that auto-creates test scripts, and an advanced script editor with features like syntax highlighting, code completion, and context-sensitive help. It has Test Execute, a lightweight utility for running distributed tests, and Test Recorder, a library for building tests into your application. And if you plan on using Visual Studio 2005 Team System, Test Complete integrates nicely with it and adds a new Test Complete test type. So, do yourself a favor and download a free evaluation copy of Test Complete at automatedqa.com. All right. So who is Raya?
I don't know if it's Raya or Rhea, but I believe it's actually the name of the Indian gentleman who runs this site. It's the name of his daughter. And this is a photo site, like a photo sharing site, you know, kind of in the realm of the Shutterflies, the Snapfish, and the Smug Mug. But this Raya is actually a more of an AI and an intelligence experiment than a photo sharing experiment. A lot of times we want to tag our data, tag our photos with information. I know that I've used Picasa, the free photo sharing application from Google, and I've wanted to say, well, I'll go through and find pictures of grandma, tag them as grandma, find pictures of Zenzo, tag him as Zenzo, and then if I want to find pictures, blah, 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 blah. And tagging never works because the data typically gets sloppy. You don't tag a photo, you mistag a photo. What this Raya attempts to do is look at the photos and actually recognize faces. It'll ask you, who is that? That's Uncle Phil. Oh, are these five of Uncle Phil? Okay, cool.
Oh my
I got
God.
A pretty good idea of what Uncle Phil looks like. And it'll find him in low light and highlight. Now, it's all an invite-only alpha right now, but Am Malik on his website was recently wondering out loud if Google was going to buy these people. And whether Google buys them or not, or whether they do their own thing, the idea that this kind of analysis could be done on a picture just really opens up the possibilities. And if you take that along with the tagging and metadata-based technology that's coming in Longhorn, now called Vista, and their WinFS file system, why can't my PC, rather than doing SETI at home and trying to find aliens in its spare time, be chewing on my pictures and saying, oh, I recognize that this is Christmas 2005, and here's a bunch of different pictures of trees or whatever. So
that's really insane if you think about it.
You know, it's really insane, but at the same time, if you read a lot of things like, you know, Philip K. Dick or science fiction, this is what they've been telling us we were going to have since computers started. And it's just a lot harder than I think a lot of people really thought. And, you know, and this is actually why we bring into things like this Mechanical Turk thing that I was actually talking to you earlier about.
Right. Amazon Mechanical Turk.
Right. So the Mechanical Turk was a carnival act that was taken around. It was basically a machine that looked like a Turkish gentleman, and it was a robot, but there was actually a person hidden in a box, and you'd ask the Mechanical Turk about your life, and then a piece of paper would come out explaining what he thought about you. And it was just done with a guy in a box with a typewriter. But the concept of a Mechanical Turk, a machine that's augmented by humans, has been taken to the next level by Amazon, who's actually got a collection of, I like to call them meta elves. You've got all these elves out there. These are all these people who have nothing better to do than to go to Am I Hot or Not and click on a radio button. Why don't we pay them 2 cents to actually do some work that would ordinarily cost us a lot of money? So if I had a bunch of pictures, maybe I'm a real estate agent, I've got a whole wad of pictures, and I want to say, which one of these pictures is a good shot of the storefront of this particular property? I give that data to Amazon. They load it into their Mechanical Turk, and they say, put it in a queue. And then these people who sign up for the Mechanical Turk process go, and they go up to the website, and it says, is this a good picture of the storefront? This, and here's three versions, and they click a radio button. And if they're if they've done their job right, they get 2 cents. So one could potentially make, you know, I don't know how fast they are, and if they're trying not to to be sloppy, $6, $7, $8, $10 an hour as a Mechanical Turk.
So some guy in California types in a question and somebody else answers it, basically, that's what they're doing?
Right now they're doing it with images. So, you know, is this a picture of? And they're actually using it as a test for their maps.amazon.com, which is Amazon's storefront mapping. They basically had a number of vans with GPSs driving around metropolitan areas, taking pictures out of the left and right side of the van. So then when I type in, I need to go to Powell's bookstore, not only do they give me directions, but they also say, and here's a picture of Powell's so you know it when you see it. So then they will, they're using this now, rather than having a computer try to figure out if that's a good shot of Powell's bookstore, they put it into the queue. So it's really a test of this queuing technology that they've got.
That's and very
I think
interesting.
You're going to see that expanded out to other kinds of problems that, a lot like Google Answers, where you can go up and ask a question and pay $5 for it. When you really want processing power, like these Rhea.com people, they can get it working 99%, but they're always going to miss pictures of Uncle Phil. Why can't the elves, the meta elves out there, do that for me?
Awesome. All right, one more, and then let's talk bugs. Zazzle.com.
Speaking of pictures and pictures with people's faces on it, I was really impressed with Zazzle.com, Zazzle.com, because I could go up and actually purchase postage with the picture of my son on it. Fantastic stuff. Cost about twice as much as a regular stamp. Stamps are up to 40 cents. I think I paid 80 cents, 90 cents a stamp. But I get a nice big fat stamp with a two-dimensional barcode on it. Each stamp is unique, so you can't do these yourself. It's all done through Pitney Bowes, but Zazzle licenses the stuff. I know things like this have been done before, but the Ajaxy interface that they had set up, it worked great in Firefox. Literally in 5 minutes, I had this thing set up. I had my sheet of stamps. I can design it. And then it showed up like 2 days later. So it's like Shutterfly, except it's got postage. We're doing all of our baby thank you notes with Zazzle.com stamps. Very cool.
Very cool. All right. So what kind of bugs did we encounter this week, Scott?
Well, I was pretty much bug-free at work, not because we write bug-free code, but because I wasn't writing code this week. But I'm going to take advantage of some of my friends and some of the bugs that they came up with. John Box, who's got a blog up at johnbox.netdeveloperjournal.com. Again, all links will be up at the hanselminutes.com show site. This is right. Show number 2. John Box had a really crazy bug where he was finding on a particular machine the cookies were getting dropped. He was trying to do some very basic ASP.NET forms authentication. He got a nice reproduction set up where he would go to a site as an anonymous user, log in, cookie doesn't show up. So then he starts sniffing that stuff. When you find these kinds of bugs where you're feeling that your cookies are being either slapped down or not being returned, you want to pull out a tool like Fiddler, fiddlertool.com, or my favorite, which is IE HTTP headers that Jonas Blunk put together. And these integrate with IE and lets you actually sniff the traffic that we don't typically see, that header traffic, whether it be caching headers or cookies and stuff. So he actually posted this up to a news group that we're on, and we saw very clearly that that cookie was being handed back. And initially we were thinking, is this ASP.NET somehow? But if you look at his sniffing, it was pretty clear that it was handed to IE, and on the next request, IE simply didn't hand it back.
And it wasn't something dumb like cookies were turned off in IE.
No. Typically when you find these kind of things out, you want to look at are cookies turned on? What is your security set out?
Right.
If your security set it high, the most common thing on a public website is not having a P3P or a compact privacy policy set up, because IE will often toss cookies that it finds to be a little suspect, especially if your site does not have an actual express privacy policy.
Mm-hmm.
I thought his cookie was being kicked back by privacy policy, but turned out that there was a security update pushed out to IE recently, and actually Jeff Berkowitz on my blog called that out, and then John talked to Microsoft support, and we think that it's been confirmed. It's actually a Microsoft KB article, 312461, that says that when you have a DNS name or a server name that has an underscore in it, that's a risk. And so IE will actually kick that back silently. IE was refusing the cookie because his server name had an underscore.
That's really wild.
It was totally wild. And when we threw it out, a bunch of guys said, oh, I totally had that happen to me. And this is one of those bugs where you just have to say it out loud once. And once you've heard it, it'll never happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
But it had never hit John before. I hadn't seen it before. Now I know not to put underscores in my domain names. Turns out that having an underscore in your domain name, and again, this was an internal domain. I think it was like my underscore server that was being sent back. It's just not cool. So don't do it. It's not RFC compliant.
And the big bug, of course, Rocky Laka brought to our attention, but apparently it's been kicked around a little bit, about how in ASP.NET, threads can switch on you in the back end in ASP.NET unexpectedly, thus rendering the security context and everything else sort of moot.
Right.
What's that all about?
Yeah, it's a pretty crazy bug. A lot of people have felt that once a request comes into ASP.NET, that I can count on my underlying thread to be my underlying thread and to not change. And it really comes down to kind of that definition of what is unexpectedly. ASP.NET's job is to manage this pool of worker threads, and its whole goal is to avoid any kind of blocking. Anytime a thread is blocked, that's a thread that could be doing something else. So it does everything that it can to prevent that. Now, this actually harkened back to some older stuff that I had posted about the thread static attribute. This is an attribute that you can put onto a variable that says, You're like a static, except every thread has a copy of you. And what can happen is if your request is switched out and some other request comes in and uses your thread in the pool there, that information that you've decided to store in that thread static attribute is going to be opened up to them. So right. I just said in a very short blog post, don't use a thread static attribute with ASP.NET. Right. And an Australian named Piers7 referenced that older post and really went to the next level, did a lot of very good experimentation, and we'll post a link to his post. And Rocky discovered this because, you know, Rocky's all about the business objects. He wrote the book on business objects, and he said, well, I need to count on my thread level data as I pass things from ASP.NET into my business objects. And most importantly, he was concerned about the current principle of the thread.
You know,
who am I? My security information. It was causing a lot of problems. And the issue is that some people say requests were thread agile, meaning that things could get swapped out at any time. And that's wrong. Other people say requests are pinned to a thread for the lifetime. And that's wrong. And we actually talked about this a number of different times, and we couldn't figure it out. So we went to Scott Guthrie, and he was kind enough to really put this to rest.
It was amazing, the response. I mean, somebody said, hey, Scott Guthrie should read this. And like the next day, he said, I just now got this thread, and here's what it's all about.
Right. So it turns out that there are a number of things that are on the thread that ASP.NET will move for you when it switches into another thread. The idea is that if you're using something like asynchronous pages with ASP.NET 2.0, perhaps you've written an HTTP handler and you're using some async, or more likely you've written an HTTP module, even though it's true that it's not possible to have your thread pulled out from underneath you when you have code actively running, it is possible that your thread will change out from underneath you between maybe the begin request and the authenticate request. Because if you're doing something that's going to block, then they're going to possibly pass your thread off somewhere else. Turns out that ASP.NET will automatically propagate the thread.currents principle, the HTTP context user property, and the culture information. This was the other big concern, is that your thread actually has the notion of culture. Who you are, your UI, your thread dot, your current culture ID and your current UI culture, all of that stuff is propagated. So it turns out that the data that you put on the thread, though, if you're using things like thread local storage, will not come along. It's not their responsibility to pull that stuff over. So if you're going to be doing stuff in ASP.NET where you want to store things in what you feel is the current thread, put those things in HTTP context.items.
Right. It's never been a good idea, as far as I know, to store things in the thread itself, especially in .NET where the threads aren't really a thread.
Specifically in ASP.NET where you have this notion of my execution context, but you're right, the underlying thread is managed by some other thing.
Right.
Now, if you were doing all this in a WinForms app or a console app, people put stuff thread local all the time.
Yeah, because you're in control of it most of the time.
Exactly. The moral of the story is that ASP.NET owns your threads in ASP.NET, so you need to treat them with respect. And if you spin up your own thread, you run some work on another thread, it's up to you to transfer that data over that you might need. And it is important to note that the threads aren't changing, quote-unquote, without warning. They're not actually changing while the code is running, but at those kind of transition points where ASP.NET has exposed a particular event, it can be a problem.
All right. Scott, I think we got to call it a show. It's been a good one.
Yeah, I think it went pretty well. And I really do want to say that we appreciate everyone's feedback. This is a work in progress. I hope we made your commute a little easier. I hope that you'll recommend this to your friends. Continue to send me ideas for tools, bugs that you've had that we can talk about, gadgets, life hacking, whatever it takes. And we'll try to incorporate it into future versions of Hansel Minutes.
And next week, we'll talk about my new Prius.
You got a Prius?
I am.
Oh, dude.
We're in hacker heaven.
I love my Prius. I'm going to get Windows booting up on that big LCD screen. You watch it.
Me too. All right, we'll talk about it next week on Hansel Minutes. Bye-bye.